Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How and what will you eat this year? My guest today is responsible not only for tracking down some of the world's greatest recipes and the cooks who perfect them, but also for keeping a finger on the pulse of American culture and how it affects what we put on our tables and into our bodies. Amy Albert is Senior Associate Editor for Bon Appetit magazine. She's in town to judge the 25th annual Dallas Morning News Wine Competition. Results will be published during the Dallas Wine and Food Festival, which takes place April 22nd through 26th. Amy, welcome to Think.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
We should start with this. You are just in from the judging location. And how much wine have you tasted this morning?
This morning, between 9 and 12, I had 50 Cabernets, 1 Charbonneau, and 36 Zinfandels.
That seems like, of all things, it seems stressful to me.
It's not, actually. It's very relaxing. First of all, there's not a crowd watching us and nobody's cheering and we don't actually know what the wines are. Mm-hmm. We know what the variety is. For example, we know we're judging Cabernets. We don't know what vineyards they're from, what producers they're from. We do know vintages in some cases. And it's a wonderful opportunity to interact with these loopy, opinionated, smart people in the wine business that you only get to see once a year at this thing that happens in Dallas. It's pretty great.
And are you ever curious after the whole thing is over and the judging is complete to see what exactly it was that you were tasting?
Oh, we're dying to know. We always want to know. And we keep our notes, in fact. All of us keep our notes, and we were talking last night about how we look at them on the plane and wonder if, you know, what the heck it was, and we even write down what we think it is. And then weeks after, we get the results, and often the results have to be embargoed. They'll tell us, but they'll say, please keep this a secret until the festival or until the formal announcement is made.
So you can go out and get a bottle or two, but you can't let anybody else know the big secret.
Right. That's right.
So is the economy really affecting trends in food right now?
Oh, it definitely is. What's really great for Bon Appetit, and I think it's great for everybody, is that people are cooking at home more. And the fact is, a lot of food that you can cook at home is fast food. For example, fish. Fish takes 5 to 7 minutes to cook, and it's a heck of a lot better for you than the burger and fries that you're going to stand in line for. Although burger and fries definitely have their place. I love them, but
it's funny to think that we lost track of that for such a long time.
We did. And restaurants become what I call it food spotting, where people talk about chefs as if they were sports figures. And that's neat and nifty and it has its place. But home cooking is where it's at. And it's also a really good way to see your friends and family without having to make a reservation, spend a lot of money, or yell in a really loud restaurant. And again, in no way am I dissing restaurants. I worked in restaurants for years. We cover them extensively at the magazine. But in the end, the magazine to me is a how-to manual for pleasure and empowerment. And my colleagues often laugh at me because I say, you know, am I going to make this and feel like a genius afterwards? Because if I get that I am a bloody genius feeling after I make something, then I've done my job. We've done our job for readers. And so the word empowerment is often overused, I think, but it applies here.
Well, no, it makes sense to me as sort of a novice cook, because when something succeeds, you really do feel like, oh, it's not so hard after all.
Exactly. And you know, if you make a cake and it looks like the picture, there's that excitement. But if you make something and you've never tried it before and it really works, there's this aha moment and you want to try it again. And maybe you want to tweak it yourself and make it your own and make a few changes. And I love that.
Do you think restaurant culture has sort of put some people off cooking? Because we know the food is so great. We do sort of idolize these great chefs, and then we assume that that's just leagues above what we'll ever accomplish.
I think it's twofold. Yes. Part of it is I'll never be able to entertain my friends and make it taste or look as good as what I can get if I go out to eat at Dean Fearing's restaurant. But the other thing is that we look at these chefs and think, what if I tried that? What if I really learned to sear a steak really beautiful, like I see the guy on the line doing at this open kitchen restaurant that I just went to last week where I had a really good meal? So I think the aspirational part of it is really great, but the intimidation, no.
So are you always watching when you go to a restaurant? Can you separate work from that?
I can, but it's a really good question. It's a hazard of the job. We went to Dolly Wine Bar last night. They took all the judges, and it was wonderful. But, of course, I had to go and see what was happening behind the line and watch the waiters. And it's just part of the job. But I enjoy it. I enjoy it. And it's often it really enhances the experience because you know that what it takes to put together what ends up being on your plate is it's a lot more than just the prettiness and the good recipe. There's a lot of choreography that happens in a restaurant.
Amy Albert is here from Bon Appetit magazine. She's in town to judge the 25th annual Dallas Morning News wine competition. Results will be published during the Dallas Wine and Food Festival at the end of April. So when you're looking at trends, do you go first to the restaurants and see what people might emulate at home? Or do you go to places where food is sold and ask about what ingredients people are buying?
Wow, that's a good question. It's both, actually. In my job, I'm really lucky because I get to talk to purveyors a lot and I see what turns them on. And there's a show that happens twice a year called the Fancy Food Show. There's one in New York and there's one in San Francisco. And often when you go and you see the things that people are bringing into the country or selling or wanting to get distribution for, that can be a bellwether for the market. 18 months from now, for example, remember when a few years ago, all of a sudden you began to see all this flavored hummus everywhere.
Yeah.
Well, I remember, you know, seeing that 18 months before it started to appear at the Fancy Food Show and making a note to myself and thinking, huh, note to self, hummus and not just the classic stuff. So that happens. But also chefs play a very big role in what we end up putting on our tables. In the March issue of the magazine, which is on the stands right now, we've got this fantastic story on caramel and all the ways that you make it. And caramel is this magical thing because basically it's sugar, sometimes water, although you don't have to, and a little bit of cream. And poof, you've got this amazingly comforting, roasty, sweet, delicious thing. Now, initially, chefs started doing this and it had a retro appeal. But then I think people wanted to start eating caramel desserts in their homes and wanting to make this at home. And a lot of people didn't realize how simple it was. So that's a trend where we saw it in restaurants and we knew that this was just something that home cooks really, really wanted for themselves.
It's fascinating to me how often things that do become trends in restaurants start with what is very simple cuisine. Like you mentioned, caramel is very simple and hummus is peasant food.
Mm-hmm.
But then it becomes the hot new thing.
It does become the hot new thing. There's another thing. One of my favorite stories that we got to do recently was in the January issue, and it's online at bonappetit.com, is homemade ricotta. Mm-hmm. This is another example of three ingredients. You've got milk, you've got lemon juice, and salt, and that is it. And in 15 minutes, you're a cheese artisan.
And who knew that? I mean, I didn't know that you could make it yourself and that it would take no time at all.
Yep. And it's really satisfying. I mean, the American cheese revolution, as I call it, artisan cheeses in America are way better than they were 10 years ago. And I think now what's happening is people want to know how to do that themselves. And chefs are starting to make their own cheeses in the restaurants. And so we thought it would be really nifty to teach people how to make ricotta at home. And the fact is, in 15 minutes, you have fresh cheese. It's delicious, warm, and then it keeps for a couple of days, but it never lasts that long in my fridge, and I live by myself. So,
you write a lot of the prep school columns, which amount to how-to for different things. Do you sort of always basically know where to start, or do you research with five different cooks or chefs to find out exactly what you want to include in those pieces?
What I do is look at what's going to be in the magazine in any given issue. And I have to stand back because I have worked as a professional cook. So I have to stand back and say, if I were trying this for the first time, what do I need to know? What do I need to see? What do I need to reassure me that this isn't going to be a total waste of time and money? So that's what I think about when I'm putting that together. And also what's visually interesting. Caramel, which we have step-by-step instructions for in the March issue, was really cool because you obviously it's too hot to taste. It's over 300 degrees, but you can tell the doneness by color. By looking at caramel, you can see when it's golden, it's going to be mildly roasty. When it's amber, it's going to be medium. And when it's dark, it's going to have almost that bitter edge. And I can't think of too many foods where a color gives you such a clear indication of what it's actually going to taste like. So I knew visually that was a good fit.
So the March issue is all about comfort foods. And, you know, it's always tempting to think, well, now we like comfort food. But it seems like we say this no matter what's going on with the economy and everything else. Is it different now? It seems like some of the things that you write about are not so much about a different version of what grandma made. They're comfort foods, but they're not necessarily the most traditional things that we grew up eating.
No, I would say not. In fact, the comfort menu that we did has some deep fried food in it. And to some people, that's comfort food. But to some people, that's bar food. So I think the difference is that it's comfort food, but it's got an interesting twist, whether it's kind of a French twist or whether it's a Spanish twist or whether it's just a new way of looking at comfort food and as the fact that it could be something that you eat when you have a beer. One of the biscuit recipes in a recent issue we did that's online, I think it's about breakfast and the fact that breakfast is this really popular meal. And these biscuits from this Southern chef are traditionally made, but they've got this added French step where you actually fold the dough over itself. And so you get these flaky layers that rise up. And that's a French technique for making puff pastry, but you use it in biscuits too. So it's comfort food, but with some kind of another twist or another interpretation.
And was that the recipe where you talked about putting layers of, is it butter in between?
Yes.
So that it really rises?
Yeah. And the technical term for that is laminating, but which doesn't sound so appetizing really.
That's my old way of cooking.
Right.
It comes in a plastic bag. How often do you have to work with something that you really don't personally like and you have to sort of overcome that?
Not very often, because this is journalism and you're a journalist, so you know you're curious about everything.
Yeah.
So I don't have to do that very often. And if I do, I have to sort of sit back and suspend my judgment and just say, is this a good example of what it is? But not often. Although it's funny because certain people in the magazine they have certain aversions. One person doesn't like garlic. One person doesn't like shiitake mushrooms. And at first I thought, oh, how narrow-minded. But I've come to understand that certain people have certain sensitivities. And this may be the next great frontier of food research, actually, is food sensitivities and people who can super taste certain things.
Mm-hmm. Science is always sort of under, we don't necessarily see it when we read the magazine, but it's a big part of how you approach what you're doing.
It is. But in the end, for our readers, I don't think they want to know that much science. I think if they do, they have other places to go. That's not what Bon Appetit is giving them. Bon Appetit is giving them the pleasure of having done this really well and sharing it with friends.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Thomas in Dallas. Hey, Thomas.
Yeah, I was always sort of loved just beans, rice, and cornbread or something, and wondered if you're talking about that simpler food, and wondering if you've seen sort of a rise in that in the restaurant trade. I've always wondered if you could open sort of a soup kitchen, and then a twist on that would be to serve it on porcelain in the front and on styrofoam by the garbage can in the back, you know, for different prices. But anyway.
Simpler foods in restaurants?
I think anytime you're delivering something that people really want and hits a sweet spot, you've got a really great idea. And yes, I definitely am seeing that.
Is that cost cutting, or do you think, again, it's just a response to what people are thinking about?
I think it's a response to what people are thinking about right now. There's something about a simple food that makes us feel better, that makes us feel like it's time well spent, but it has to be really beautifully executed.
Amy Albert is my guest. She is Senior Associate Editor for Bon Appetit magazine. She's in town for the 25th Annual Dallas Morning News Wine Competition. The competition goes on this week. We won't find out the results until the end of April at the Dallas Wine and Food Festival, when the results will also be published in the paper. You are welcome to join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering flexible part-time graduate study. You can cultivate your curiosity at SMU and learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Amy Albert, who is Senior Associate Editor for Bon Appetit magazine. She's in town to judge the 25th Annual Dallas Morning News Wine Competition. If you want to join us today, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. You mentioned this briefly earlier, but I want to talk a little bit more about it. One big restaurant trend is these breakfast meals. Why are chefs suddenly paying more attention to breakfast when ordinarily they would have had someone sort of lower ranking dealing with the breakfast shift?
I think one of the reasons is because, well, there are a few reasons. People are super busy. So breakfast has become a meal over which people now do business. It's especially true in LA, where the magazine is based. The other thing is it's cheaper. And the foods that we eat for breakfast are often cheaper. And the other thing is, and this is linked with another trend that we saw this year, eggs. People are really into eggs. Eggs aren't evil. In fact, they're a perfect food, and they're cheap. And they can offer this richness and this big payoff for not very much money and not very much effort.
And a lot of dishes now have eggs sort of perched on top.
Yes, eggs on everything. We did a story where we have a pizza, which, again, you can find the recipe on bonappetit.com, a pizza with an egg on top, poached egg tossed with pasta, and just poached eggs on salad, of course, which is a classic that you find in French restaurants and bistro restaurants that's definitely coming back.
One of the pieces that you wrote was how to poach an egg, which is one of those things that I've always shied away from because it seems just terrifying and difficult. But it doesn't sound that hard once you explain it.
No, it isn't terrifying and difficult. And there are all these myths about poaching an egg, like, oh, you have to make a vortex and you must put vinegar in the water and all these things that sound really intimidating and really chefy and would just put you off.
The word vortex, that's enough right there.
Right. Probably doesn't belong with food in any sense of the word. However, it's really very, very easy. The biggest thing is that eggs that are cold work better. Putting an egg in a custard cup and just slipping it into the water is a really good idea. And using a fish spatula, which is a spatula that has perforations in it, will make it much easier to lift the delicate poached egg. Otherwise, that's it. Now, if you're really, the egg is going to get a little bit sort of filamenty looking as it poaches, and if you're really fussy about that, you can just trim them off. But otherwise, you've got a poached egg, and it's okay if it doesn't look perfect.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Razik in Arlington. Hi, Razik.
Hi. I'm not really a cook, but I promised my girlfriend that I'd make like a belated Valentine's Day dinner. I'm looking for something, I guess, kind of simple.
Mm-hmm.
So I was just wondering if you have any ideas, and I'll take the call off the air.
Thanks for your call.
That's a really sweet question, and there are tons of ideas. First of all, don't feel like you have to make the whole thing. Focus on one really nice main course thing. Maybe it's a chicken breast. Maybe it's a duck breast, which is super easy to cook. It's basically as easy as a steak. Or do a really fantastic steak and then squeeze lemon over it and chop a few herbs and scatter them over. And then buy dessert at a nice pastry shop. And it's okay, especially Valentine's Day is often on a weeknight. Go to the grocery store and buy mixed greens in bulk. It's okay not to feel like you have to cook her a five-course meal. And you can buy prepared stuff and feel fine about that. And I think it's wonderful that you want to cook for her, and she's lucky.
You also have done something recently about kale. And I guess kale is something people were terrified to do, but now it's back, and it's really good. And you have like a fried kale.
Yeah, hail kale, I say. You can't get enough of it. I can't get enough of it. And it's really, really easy to make. The kale recipe that you're speaking of is actually roasted kale. It's lacinato kale, which is a dark green variety that's crinkled. And it's a lot more tender than the stuff that looks purple and is super, super roughly that you often see growing in raised beds and shopping malls. Lacinato kale is packed with really good stuff for you, tons of vitamins and tons of flavor. So the recipe you're speaking of is simply lacinato kale leaves. They're brushed with olive oil, sprinkled with salt, and then you roast them at 350 for I think about, I believe it's 25 minutes, and you get these amazingly crispy appetizers that taste kind of like seaweed, if you're into that, and they're really, really good snack food.
Would that work with, I recently started cooking the beet greens instead of throwing them in the trash, and I'm wondering if the same recipe would apply to other kinds of greens.
Absolutely, and good on you for doing that. There's a really, really simple, basic recipe for cooking greens that I use because I try to eat more greens. I don't always succeed, but one thing I would say is just buy them. Have them there. They're hearty. They keep in the fridge for a few days. So very simply, heat some olive oil, put a little garlic in the pan. The moment it gets fragrant, put the greens in the pan, stir them around. When they're well coated with the olive oil, put a tiny bit of liquid in it. It can be broth, it can be water, cover, and then in about 7 minutes, you'll have perfectly cooked greens. And that's it. And you're doing something really good for you and for your taste buds.
I'm not going to ask you the tired question about how you stay so slim when you do what you do, but I am curious. You must have to make choices every day because there are so many things that you have to taste for work, and then you still have to plan meals. Do you have to sort of plan out your eating throughout the week so that you know that you've got space in your diet for what you have to do?
Yes, I do. For example, getting greens into my diet is a really important part of that. When we taste things at the magazine, we do not sit down with Spode China and Baccarat Crystal and Linens. It's not like that.
Come on.
Everyone thinks that, but we're sitting and each person gets a tiny little taste and we have to evaluate it very carefully. But often what that taste is a little tiny piece of chicken, a salsa recipe that we had to retest because maybe it wasn't quite right the previous week. Possibly a cocktail, in which case it's just a sip, and then maybe a little sliver of cake. Now, that's not actually very satisfying as a meal. It's wonderful to be in a job where you use your senses and taste things and evaluate so carefully and come to a conclusion with everybody, but often you actually get a stomach ache. So at the end of the day, what I like to do is eat really simply. And so greens for sure. And I do a lot of things with broth and with noodles and with thinly sliced vegetables. So I go home and it doesn't take a very long time to cook. And also very simple flavors. The gentleman who called before that talked about simple foods, that's a big thing for me is simple, straight ahead flavors.
You talked about the wine judges earlier being very smart and very opinionated. I have to imagine some passionate disagreements break out among the staff at Bon Appetit.
They do sometimes, but we have to come to a consensus. And we know, for example, that, as I said before, certain of my colleagues do like certain things and certain of them don't. But in the end, I think we really understand that what our readers want, and that's, in the end, that's what we're talking about. It doesn't really matter if I like something or not. I mean, I do, and in fact, I'm incredibly lucky because 99.9% of the time we get recipes and that taste amazing and they don't need very much work. And when they do, we fix them. But it's about the readers. It's about keeping a finger on the pulse of what people in this country are wanting to eat, what they're curious about, and what they love. And that's fascinating to me.
75% of your readers are women. The average age is something like 50. Mm-hmm. And yet, the world of professional cooking is still dominated by men. Why is that?
I think because the kitchen is a really hard place. Honestly, I couldn't hack it there. I tried, and it's really, really rough.
Socially or just having to be on your feet all the time?
It's both. Mm-hmm. It's both. And it's still very much a man's world. However, there are far more women chefs in the kitchen than there ever were when I was doing this years ago. And I think that barrier is really breaking. And although Anthony Bourdain in Kitchen Confidential made this really machismo statement about this happening and that happening, he also made sure to write about the women who were standing up to this bad treatment. And that's happening more and more. And also kitchens are much more civilized places than they used to be. It's very physically hard. And I always liken it to show business. I just think you have to be really hungry and really want it.
And the timing of every single thing that comes through the kitchen all night has got to be incredibly hard, too.
It is. And I had the opportunity a few years ago to go to a restaurant called Charlie Trotter's in Chicago and actually go behind the line. And he started yelling at me and he was saying, "Chef, taste that. Is it ready? Wipe that plate." And I just was I had that line buzz, as I called it, that buzz where I'm working the line. And I just, when it was over, I just couldn't come down. And I went right back to when I used to come home at 2 a.m. and wouldn't be able to go to sleep because of this jangly, nervous state that I was in from having worked in a kitchen all night.
And yet it's funny because so many people who like to cook at home have exactly the opposite. They love to be able to come home and know that they can turn off whatever else was going on all day and focus on the food.
Well, it's very meditative. It's very much about being in the moment. It's when you are, I sometimes teach knife skills. And one thing I say to people is the moment that you stop being present is when you're going to cut yourself. This doesn't, you know how to do this, you can do this. But the moment your mind wanders is usually when you cut yourself. And it's actually the same thing with, you mentioned staying slim. There's something about mindful eating that I really like to think about, is just taking the time to taste, taking the time to chop the onion, taking the time to taste the food.
Amy Albert is my guest. She's here from Bon Appetit magazine. We have an email from Bill in Dallas who says, "One of my favorite dishes introduced to me by an Iranian friend is rice with dill weed and lima beans. The bottom of the rice pot is lined with pita bread and butter, which turns into croutons to add crunch later. You complete the dish with a fried egg on top, yolk preserved, and you puncture the yolk and let it run into the rice."
That sounds fantastic. I would like some of that right now, please. Yeah. And the thing about that dish that always sells me is the dill weed. I love dill.
Mm-hmm. Are there herbs that come and go in terms of trendiness?
Let's see. Well, not so much. I haven't seen that. I've seen herbs being used in different ways that are trendy. Herbs and desserts, for sure, that's a trend I really, really love. I had a lemon ice cream with thyme in it that it's such a brilliant thing, and it's really, really simple. And again, it doesn't take a fancy turn of hand to be able to do this. And of course, there's the old cilantro argument. And there's actually a website apparently called IHateCilantro.com. And my colleague Andrew Knowlton, who is the foodist, blogs about this, just people who can't stand the soapy taste of cilantro. So I don't know if that's as much a trend. I think no one knew what cilantro was 10 years ago, but with all the Mexican and Asian food that we have, really good food that we have available to us now, people know what it is. So that's not going away.
Yeah, and in fact, I read that piece, and he wrote, basically, you better get used to it, because there's virtually every kind of cuisine now is incorporating this. So
it's true. It's true.
I'm curious, because you guys have a dynamite website, and I wonder if you assume that readers of the hard copy magazine always use the two in tandem, or you have to be mindful of the fact that some people will only come to the magazine and other people will only go to the website.
It's a good question. I think it's both, but we don't assume that they're going to know to go online. We often have to point that out to them. We just launched the website a year ago. In fact, I spent a week in New York working on it with everybody. It's been very, very exciting, the launch of bonappetit.com. And I think we have a lot of back and forth traffic, which is very, very nice. And hopefully we'll have more.
Mm-hmm. I want to get back to the question about men and women again briefly. Do you think that people at home, do men cooking at home approach the task in a different way than women do?
I think guys like more big toys and gadgets more than women do.
The big grill out back?
Yeah, the big grill and the big food processor with the big capacity. On the other hand, guys really like knives too. I do too, I have to say. And I have quite a few. But honestly, you only need a few. You only need a 6-inch chef's knife, maybe if you have small hands, or an 8-inch chef's knife and a paring knife, and perhaps a cleaver if you work with meat a lot and do a lot of Asian cooking.
Would you never in a million years put your knives in the dishwasher?
No, but I don't own a dishwasher.
So you're
but
safe.
I wouldn't.
Let's talk for a minute about food writing. Can you talk about what distinguishes a really great food writer from somebody who's passable but mediocre?
Wow, that's a really good question. I think the best food writers bring their life experience into it. They're funny and they're irreverent and they don't assume anything. As far as wine writing, I've been thinking about this because we've been doing tasting notes at the competition for the wines that we give gold medals to. And there's a school of wine training born of the British school of blind tasting, which teaches you to deduce what the thing is. You think of all the things that it's not. And then you think, does it smell like raspberry leaf or does it smell like raspberries? And that level of minutiae is something that most readers don't care about and they don't want to know about. But the reason that that still exists in food writing is because of that old school stuff. So I would say good food writing is about making you present with the sensation, but not in a way that's off-putting. They have to be what I call yum-yum words, for lack of a better term.
So you would use the word bubblegum or something to describe the way a wine smells as opposed to looking for something very, very technical.
I would, but I almost...
That may be a bad choice of words, but...
Bubblegum. There's one... We tasted a lot of Zinfandels this morning, and a lot of them smelled like a cherry Jolly Rancher. Do you remember Jolly Rancher candy?
Sure.
And they smelled like that, and that's not necessarily a bad thing.
Mm-hmm. When you read something, does it make you want to taste what's been prepared there, or does it make you want to go and make the recipe your own?
It depends. When I read about things in other countries, it makes me want to go. Mm-hmm. When I read the stories that come in, we did something on Lima, Peru, and it made me really want to go and drink pisco sours and eat quinoa and all the ways that it can be prepared there. But good writing makes me want to get cooking in the kitchen too. It makes me want to try something. And there's always the neat thing about working at a food magazine is there are. When I write this prep school column, I do it very much with the test kitchen because people see the Bon Appetit test kitchen as NASA. You know, they think that all these secret things go on there, and in fact they don't. But what it is that the five people who are on the food staff full time all have different ways of looking at things, and then I might have a different way of doing it too. So that's the really interesting part of it is that you're talking to your colleagues who all have different ways to get to the same goal. I love that.
Amy Albert is my guest. She's senior associate editor for Bon Appetit magazine. She's in town to judge the 25th annual Dallas Morning News wine competition. The judging takes place this week. The results will be published during the Dallas Wine and Food Festival, April 22nd through 26th. We'll return to our conversation in a moment, and you can join us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering flexible part-time graduate study. You can cultivate your curiosity at SMU and learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Amy Albert is here. She is senior associate editor for Bon Appetit magazine, in town to judge the Dallas Morning News wine competition. If you want to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Let's go to Meridian and speak with Dave. Hi, Dave.
Hi. I hope you can hear me. I'm a professional chef who came back to Texas, and I survived the late 80s when Bon Appetit magazine and Martha Stewart made my life a living hell. Because they just show me recipes, go, can you do that? Like, what, take a picture of really cool-looking food? But I have a new appreciation for Bon Appetit, and I have a suggestion for a knife that most people need to try and work with at the house. If they can, it'll save them a lot of time. A 7-inch, it's pronounced Santuco. It's an Asian cooking knife with a eagle-shaped nose.
And what do you like about it, Dave?
Well, it's other than you need to keep a little paring knife around also to do what it won't do for the sharp ends and little things. But the accessibility of the whole thing, it's basically if you took a 10-inch or an 8-inch chef knife and broke it in half and put a handle on each piece, you can use those two things for just about anything you need to do at the house. I think it's an all-purpose blade, and I found it about 10 or 12 years ago, and it's just... it's not the only one I use, of course, but it comes in real handy around the house if you're doing a lot of chopping and slicing. And if you can, as you said, you taught knife skills. Well, you master that, you don't have to worry about. Well, you'll have to be careful, of course, always. But it can make your life a lot more simple, and it's a really good edge.
Thanks very much for your suggestion. Appreciate it.
The other good thing that's great about a Santuco knife is it has these little scallops on either side of the blade called collons. So when you're chopping herbs, it actually keeps the herbs from clinging to the blade.
Oh, they don't
really
stick
like.
Every time,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I want to talk about some of the ways that people are cooking at home for other people. And we were speaking in the break a little bit about potluck or these dinners where people have supper clubs and everybody kind of brings something.
I love that. I've been a big proponent of it. And everywhere I've lived, I've always been the ringleader of potluck dinners. There are a few reasons why. First of all, it takes the onus off the person who's hosting. I think when you say I'm having a dinner party and the word entertaining, which is such an intimidating word, it makes us think that we have to be Betty Draper in Mad Men, you know, serving rumaki first and then she goes back into the kitchen and then she has a rosta and she has a perfect cake prepared. But in fact, if everybody shares the menu, and if one person brings an appetizer and another brings the main course and another brings dessert, suddenly everyone has ownership of the dinner and everybody is involved. And it's, of course, a conversation jumping off point, but it's way more of a sharing experience. And with a little planning, the menu can really coordinate and it's not just a hodgepodge.
So you suggest, yeah, that people say, instead of saying, what are you good at making, you maybe direct the people who will be coming about what they might bring.
A little bit. Or if you have somebody who doesn't like to be directed, ask them what they'd like to bring and try to, you know, be a bit of a diplomat and arrange the menu around that if someone has really strong opinions. But yeah, we have a supper club menu in the magazine just about every month with guidelines for how to pull this off. And it's really fun. It's really, really fun to share the wealth, share the skills, and share the eating.
What I like about how you do that is, again, you'll say, well, the chef really ought to make the dessert or the host ought to make the dessert because there's no time or it'll fall apart if you bring it in the car from somewhere else. So there's a good idea about, you know, how many people ought to be there and who ought to chip in what.
Absolutely. And so, and then the other thing about potluck is that it fits into your life a lot better, too, because if you're, you know, you're a mom, you work all week long. If you have a few hours to make something ahead and then just it's done and you clean the house and take a bath and take a nap before everybody gets there, it just makes a lot more sense in terms of your time and having fun.
Yeah. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Mark in Dallas. Hey, Mark.
Hey, Chris. So I just want to state at the outset that when I'm work out on the treadmill, I watch the Food Channel. I still don't know if that's a good idea, but Amy, I'd like to know what shows on the Food Channel do you like? What shows on the Food Channel do you hate?
Well, I love, obviously, Iron Chef is really fun to watch. I actually don't watch a ton of food TV because I'm surrounded by it all week long, but I have to admit that the showmanship stuff is really, really fun.
Is there anything that you think has been bad for the way we eat?
Not bad for the way we eat, but sometimes bad for our expectations. I think sometimes when people see chefs doing these unbelievable feats on camera, they think that that's going to be their achievement level immediately, their first year of cooking school, and that's just not going to happen. Mm-hmm.
How often do you consciously include something in the magazine that you know is really an aspirational item, something that we might look at and enjoy but know full well that we're not about to make?
We always do because, first of all, we have a very broad level of cooks. We have people who actually will try that and fancy themselves professionals, but we have people that read the magazine like porn, you know, who doesn't? But yes, a six-layer cake is aspirational, but if you want to try it, good on you, and we're going to hold your hand the entire time and make sure that it works for you.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next to Janice in Dallas. Hi, Janice.
Hi. How are you all?
Great, thank you.
Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to ask a question. I have a restaurant here in Dallas. I'm a chef and a partner in it. And I actually have aspirations to do some writing as well. And I wondered if Amy might have some suggestions of how to kind of foray into that.
I think the best thing is to write about what you know. We were talking before about food writing that really works, and one of my favorite food writers is MFK Fisher because of how I want to know as much about her life as I do about her food. So I think the first thing you need to do is figure out what it is that really, you know, ignites the fire inside you, and then check out other people's blogs and see what they're doing and figure out how you can do it better.
Do you think the trend toward eating local and eating green is here to stay, or is this something that we're really focused on right now that may not be an issue in 3 or 4 years?
It's definitely here to stay, and it's here to stay for many, many different reasons. Organic sales are falling off because organic food is more expensive, and hopefully that will change without a lax, you know, without a falling back of standards. Yes, because people are figuring out that you can, even if you live in a tiny little apartment with a little patio out front, you can do a raised bed and you can grow your own herbs. You can stop using plastic bags by bringing your own nylon bag to the store every time you go. If you live a half a mile from a market, bike and make two trips or do shopping a few times a week. So I think that whole trend is... It's here to stay, and it's here to stay in many, many different ways. And it's going to be something where we don't have to feel so high-minded and holier-than-thou about it. It's about making choices.
I wonder how often you have occasion to go into not just a Whole Foods sort of grocery store, but the Walmart neighborhood grocery or the sort of regular places that people are going, and whether or not you feel like the selection, especially things like meats and produces, really has changed, or is that something we're all telling ourselves?
It definitely has changed. One of the best habits to get into, obviously, is, and Marion Nestle said this in her book, What to Eat, is keep shopping the periphery of the store, because that's where the fish and meat and the fruits and veg are. And you'll see that, for example, you don't just have one kind of kale anymore. You have three kinds of kale. You have three kinds of mustard greens. You have exotic fruits, yes, that were flown in from very far away. But you're also starting to see more local apple varieties, and something like a Pink Lady apple, which is happens to be one of my favorite varieties, wasn't available to us in the grocery store 2 years ago, and now we see it a lot.
One of the trends that you mentioned recently is new Southern cuisine. Mm. Sometimes when people in Texas hear Southern cuisine, we think, oh, I'm not going back there. Can you explain what new Southern is?
It's new because I think it has, again, that touch of other techniques and other nations. There's, for example, a mess of greens, a skillet of greens can have crisped onions on them, and then they get a little bit of a tartness from sherry vinegar, let's say. So that idea of slow-cooked greens, that's still there, but it gets a little bit of a Frenchy touch and a little bit of a Spanish touch.
How important is the way the food looks? Not just for photographing in the magazine, but do people pay enough attention to that?
The gentleman who called a few callers ago and talked about architectural food I heave a sigh of relief that that's not the trend anymore.
Exactly,
the stacks of food. So I think that getting away from that has really taken the emphasis off. And I think now the trend is to make your food look beautiful in very, very simple ways. For example, one chefy trick is to use a pile of mashed potatoes or celery root puree or even spinach to prop up your piece of fish or your greens. You're getting height on the plate. It sounds very chefy, but it looks really neat. And people will say, wow, how did you do that? And I love that kind of presentation stuff, and that again hails back to working the line. But I think there's importance, but less of a formal, mannered, super architectural aesthetic to it.
Another trend that came up in this year was the idea of peanut butter desserts, and I know everyone's terrified of peanut butter now, but there's plenty of safe peanut butter out there.
Yes.
What is so appealing about that? Is this sort of a comfort food thing?
I think it is, and I also think now that nuts are recognized to be the health and power food that they are, that people realize eating peanut butter is a great idea, you know, as far as getting your protein. But yes, as far as desserts, it's definitely comfort. However, it can be worked into things in very elegant ways, like buttercream on a cake, or swirled into squares, or things that are not gloppy.
Mm-hmm. I also would like to talk a little bit about when you're deciding what's going to be on the website and you're thinking, sort of planning out ahead, and you do trends. You were saying that you go to the shows and you know 18 months out. Do you try to get ahead of that, or do you try to sort of write about something just at the moment it's happening so that it feels familiar to people?
It's a really good question. I think if we see things that we know are going to, we think are going to be big a little while from now, we have to wait. However, when you plan a magazine, you're thinking a year ahead. So it's a pretty delicate balance. We did a story in the February issue on California olive oils, which are getting way, way better than they used to be. It's the industry is nascent. It's like the wine industry was in California 40 years ago. I'd been seeing California olive oils for a while, but there was a decision where, and it happens actually in an editorial meeting where there's a critical mass of people that says, yes, this is the time, this is ready, or no, we're not ready yet. And that's always how you make a magazine, is by consensus.
Well, and you said that you plan a year out. So are you writing things 9 months out?
No, I'm not writing 9 months out. We're thinking, for example, we put the February issue to bed in, I guess, November. So we just met to plan February 2010. Now, that's not written in stone, but we're in February now. So we're thinking about the kind of food that we want to eat in February, the places that we want to go in February, the things that we're buying in the grocery store when it's February, which is a lot better idea than, you know, than planning it 6 months out. Of course, we revisit that again, but we try to plan the issue of the month. I'm getting tongue-tied here. We're trying to plan the issue in the month that we are in so that we're thinking seasonally and we're on target about what tastes good at that time of the year.
And most of your writers are staff folks, right? You don't use a whole lot of freelance talent.
We use some freelance talent, but we have so many opinions and so many ideas amongst ourselves that we often just don't have enough pages to do all that we want to do in the magazine.
Is there a lot of good-natured scrapping for particular assignments?
Not so much as you would think. I mean, it's a plum job.
Yeah.
So no, not as much as you would think, actually. I'll have to make a note to try to observe that and see.
The other thing that you wrote recently that I thought was really interesting was about Yukon Gold potatoes, which it seems like such a humble food, but, you know, everybody loves potatoes.
They do, and potatoes have gotten a really bad rap over the past few years because of the glycemic index and how it causes a spike in blood sugar and then dip. But eaten moderately, they're actually a really good source of vitamin C. And the Yukon Gold in particular is this brilliant crossover potato. It's actually a hybrid of a North Dakota potato and a Peruvian potato. So you get the potatoes in Peru are often very deep yellow. And then the North Dakota potato that it was crossed with is more of a baking potato. So you get this brilliant do-all potato that can be in a gratin, it can be baked, it can be mashed, and it tastes fabulous any way you cook it.
Well, I think people have probably just finished their lunches, but now they're going to be going out and grabbing some potatoes on the way home. Amy Albert is Senior Associate Editor for Bon Appetit Magazine, in town to judge the Dallas Morning News Wine Competition, which will have the results available at the end of April during the Dallas Wine and Food Festival. Amy, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It was so much fun.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.